Tucker Carlson again talks about US servicemen getting too close to UFOs and being seriously injured. Slovenia just became the 39th country to sign the Artemis Accords. Jason Sands is a new whistleblower describing his participation in a secret space program. A former senior Pentagon official releases insider information about an intact UFO being recovered in Kingman, Arizona in the 1950s. Why did Russia veto a UN resolution on preventing nuclear weapons in space? These and other stories on Exopolitics Today, the Week in Review.
You're listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala, your source for the uncensored truth regarding the human, extraterrestrial, global, and political agenda. Click the like button and subscribe to this channel. And now, here is Dr. Michael Sala.
Welcome to the Week in Review for April 27. There's been some significant stories that I need to cover for this week. There definitely is material worth diving deep into to just understand their exopolitical significance. So anyone wanting to get the sources of these different stories, you can just go to my Twitter feed, twitter.com/Michael Sala. And that's where all the references to the stories, to the articles, to the videos that I discuss in this Week in Review, you can find them. Also, in the description to this webinar, there'll be a link where you can just go to that Twitter feed if you need to dive deep into these stories and want to find out more about them. So I want to begin here with an interview that Tucker Carlson did on the Joe Rogan Show. And he, in that interview, he restated what he had been told by a senior Stanford medical researcher about 10 years ago, and we believe that that is actually Dr. Gary Nolan, that U.S. servicemen that got too close to UFOs were suffering severe injuries, sometimes death. So it's just, I think, noteworthy that here you have Joe Rogan interviewing Tucker Carlson, and Carlson again just retelling that story about these servicemen. And what it does is it just emphasizes the importance of people's frequency or genetic makeup, their DNA, that somehow that is a factor, and consciousness also is a factor. And people who have been inside of UFOs, who have been inside of extraterrestrial spacecraft, encountered them, they often say that the craft are alive, that they have an organic consciousness, or they can recognize and interact with emotions. So if a person isn't properly prepared, they don't have the right DNA, the right consciousness, and they touch or get too close to one of these UFOs, it can be deadly, or they can suffer a severe injury. So it was good to just have Tucker emphasizing that once again. And this is, again, just emphasizing where people, contactees in particular, that do have the genetics, that do have the consciousness, like JP, the US Army serviceman who is currently still serving and that I've been interviewing and getting updates from, and he is able to interact with these craft. And in fact, that is why he was recruited. So I think there is a clear link between military servicemen being injured as a result of getting too close to UFOs, and why the military is actively recruiting contactees like JP, who do not fit the profile of a military serviceman in terms of the kind of qualities that they are seeking, but nevertheless they need them because they actually have the ability to access this kind of technology without being seriously injured. Slovenia just became the 39th country to sign the Artemis Accords. They just signed it this week, along with Sweden and Switzerland. So in the 1 week, you actually had three European countries signing the Artemis Accords, and they are a set of bilateral accords between the United States, in particular NASA, and different countries' national space programs. So these are all bilateral agreements with the United States. They are not a multilateral agreement such as the Outer Space Treaty that was signed in the 1960s by UN member states. That is a multilateral treaty where well over, I think, 150 now nations have signed the Outer Space Treaty, and that treaty is held in a repository controlled by the United Nations. The Artemis Accords are bilateral agreements, have nothing to do with the United Nations, have nothing to do with any multilateral body other than what the United States has set up to fulfill the Artemis Accords. And there is a military organization called the Combined Space Operations Initiative, where there are a number of nations whose space commands cooperate. So that is a kind of a multilateral body similar to NATO. But as far as the Artemis Accords, this is something that is set up by the United States as a bilateral agreement. And it continues to grow. I mean, this is very important that the number of countries that are joining the Artemis Accords continues to grow. So now all major spacefaring nations, apart from Russia and China, have signed on to the Artemis Accords. And what it does is it cements U.S. leadership in space affairs for decades to come. And why is that important? What it does is it shows that there is a wide consensus, apart from Russia and China, that the US is the leader when it comes to space operations. And that is important because I think for the years ahead, the United States is actively trying to create a Star Trek future. I have again and again referred to a 2019 workshop that was held at Peterson Air Force Base, which is now called Peterson Space Force Base. And that workshop actually identified 8 future scenarios that could exist by the year 2060. And in the next 40 years, what was decided was that the United States Space Command. That was the U.S. Air Force Space Command, which is the predecessor to U.S. Space Force, that the Star Trek future would be the optimal goal for the next 40 years. So you actually have on the record that the United States Space Force is actually trying to create or bring about a Star Trek future by 2060 and avoid a future where China is the dominant space power. And so we are seeing that play out at the moment. And I have little doubt that in the future, Russia will join with the Artemis Accords and join the military framework that has been set up by the US. But that'll take a few years yet, just because of the fallout from the Ukraine conflict. Okay, so here's a trailer for the next webinar that is coming up. So this trailer goes for about nearly 4 minutes, and it just gives you an idea about the upcoming webinar on May 4, where I'm going to be going into detail into Russia's secret space program, its Tsikhor and ET alliances. I think this is a fascinating topic. I've long been interested in Russia's secret space program, and it's only recently that I've gotten a lot of information by a Russian researcher that has helped me piece together the big picture of what is going on. And I'll be discussing all of that in the webinar, and people will be learning, the attendees will learn all about this. So the trailer, you can watch that on YouTube, Rumble, and Odyssey, and it'll give you a nice teaser. And I hope you can join and be part of the webinar, which is going to take place next week. So that's the trailer to that particular webinar. Okay, so here is something that was put out by Elena Dinar, her Star Nations News, episode 27 for April 22nd. And I thought it was very interesting that she came up with new information about the moon from four officials. This is in addition to Thorhan Eredian. So at least two, and I recall that there were four personnel that she refers to in her update that are telling us about what's going on in the moon. And that's very interesting because I think the moon is definitely going to be a celestial body that we are going to be learning a lot more about over the rest of this decade. I mean, we know that there are plans to send up people to space by 2025, 2026 under the Artemis program. There is also a plan by China to establish a lunar research station, and they plan to send up personnel by the year 2030. And we're also getting reports from the Galactic Federation of Worlds about the Earth Alliance and the secret space programs setting up vast facilities on the moon that will become medical research hubs, and they're mass producing things like med beds up there. Now, whether that means people that need a med bed have to go to the moon to get that, or whether they plan to release them on Earth, I don't know how logistically they can handle that. Obviously, if they're going to just be on the moon, you would have to have a lot of money to go to the moon to be treated. So we'll see how that unfolds. But definitely another fascinating update from Elena's Star Nations News. Well worth watching that. So here's a story about a video trailer to courses that are being offered in the Exopolitics Institute for those working towards an exopolitics certificate or a diploma. So there's six courses that are going to be held over summer 2024. And there are two current instructors. I actually have taught some of the courses, and some of the courses continue to be taught, but with a different instructor to me. I began teaching exopolitics courses back around 2007, 2008, taught them for quite a few years, and then eventually I was able to pass on the courses I taught to someone else who continues to teach them. That's Manuel Lamoroy, and also Paula Harris, who is a veteran UFO researcher. She's been working since the 1970s. She's interviewed hundreds of whistleblowers, insiders, experiences. So she has a vast amount of knowledge. So between the two of them, they teach six courses that are going to be offered for summer of 2024. The courses begin on May 6th. So this is definitely something I recommend to people that want to prepare themselves for the kind of Star Trek future that we're heading towards. So definitely well worth exploring the Exopolitics Certificate Program. And the link is there, or you could just go to exopoliticsinstitute.org. Now, here's a update. This is a military contractor who I've been in communication with for more than a year now. He is working with one of the military branches. I don't want to give too many details because he is active as a contractor in the military, and he's got certain NDAs that he signed and security classifications, so he has to be very careful. But in his spare time, he is able to use his skill set to be able to investigate some of the naval ship activity all over the world, and in particular around the Atlantic Ocean in the region where the Space Arc is located, according to JP. So I've relayed information between Ruzo Zanrico, which is the pseudonym for this military contractor, and JP, which is another pseudonym because JP is also active. So we need to protect our sources, so they use pseudonyms. But I know who they are. I know who JP is. Ruzo, he hasn't yet shared detailed information about his identity and his corporation that he works with because, as I said, he's got NDAs and security classifications that he wants to maintain. So here you have an account of where the Atlantic space arc is approximately submerged, and there's a lot of Navy ships in that area. So this is the last communication from Ruzo, or this is the communication he sent me. He said, quote, "I'm watching new development way out in the mid-Atlantic where there is an unusually large number of unspecified ships gathered in groups. Don't imagine they have dropped anchor there as that is very deep water." So clearly in the mid-Atlantic there is something going on. A lot of ships are congregating, military naval ships, not just from the United States but from other countries. He continues, "Can't figure out what's going on there. In the past several years, I've never seen that occur. Do see it all the time out along the Eastern Asia coastline or near ports where supply chain is notably disrupted, but out in the middle of the North Atlantic Ocean, not making sense." So clearly near ports, major ports, such as in East Asia, which is just filled with major ports, ships will congregate and wait for a time when they can enter a major shipping port. So that happens in Eastern Asian coastline all along, but in the North Atlantic, it rarely happens. So he's asking, you know, he's saying that doesn't make sense. So here's more on the Navy ships in the areas. And here he describes some of these ships. So he'd identify some of the ships that are congregating out there in the North Atlantic in an area that he identifies as roughly where the Atlantic space arc is buried, according to JP. And when I showed JP the approximate area that Ruzo had identified, he said, yes, that's correct. The arc is submerged in that area. So Ruzo is using military grade or commercial grade shipping software to be able to generate this kind of information. I'm not an expert on that, so I really don't know enough about it to be able to comment, but I think it's very significant that he's able to use this shipping tracking software to track military ships that are going out into the Atlantic and congregating in this suspicious area where JP says the Atlantic Space Arc is located. So, you know, these are some of the ships that I was able to identify. The USAV Wilson Wharf, USAV James Liu, the Monterey, USAV Matamoros, and these are all military vessels engaged in military operations. Then he identified another ship that entered into that area, and this is a Netherlands ship, the Groningen, Royal Netherlands Navy Patrol. There's another U.S. Navy ship, the L.T. Baldomero Lopez, a logistics naval ship. So clearly there's a lot of ships that are performing some kind of military activity in a region of the Atlantic Ocean that is just to the east of the Bermuda Triangle now, because JP said that the space arc was moved out of a location in the Bermuda Triangle, which is relatively close to the US mainland, but it was moved further east into the kind of mid-Atlantic because Nordic extraterrestrials thought that that would be a better way to encourage international cooperation to investigate and utilize the technologies from the space arc. So this is some kind of very interesting data from Ruzo. Here again, he's circling the area where the ships are located. Here's the Bermuda Triangle. Over here is the U.S. mainland. You know, here's the Caribbean, or the different Caribbean islands, Cuba, Puerto Rico, and so forth. And here it is, all these ships just hanging out there in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean. What are they doing there? Well, we can speculate about it, but it could be related to the space arc. Maybe there's something else going on. Okay, so this is an additional piece of information from Russo. He said that about the naval ships that are being tracked on the software that he's able to use, and he obviously is an expert at that. Quote, forgot to mention this if it wasn't noticeable in the tracking images. When the ships change shape from a chevron to a round dot, they are stationary, holding position with no heading. Wasn't sure if everybody picked up on that. So what he's saying here is that you can see the shape of the ships is kind of like a chevron, so that means that they're moving in a particular direction, and then they kind of just stop, and that's where they're stationary. I mean, they're stationary there, so that's the suspected area where they're congregating. And JP, in his Atlantic Arc updates, has said that he often sees a number of international ships in the area because it isn't kind of like an international cooperation, or many nations are cooperating to investigate what's in the space arc, but the US was taking the lead previously when it was in the Bermuda Triangle near the US mainland, but now that it's in the Atlantic Ocean, more in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean, I think the US is still playing a dominant role, because the way JP has described it, he said that there's a donut-shaped Navy ship sitting directly above the submerged arc, and there's a elevator shaft from that donut-shaped ship going all the way down to the bottom, and it attaches to the space arc so people can come in and out. Now, when it was moved by the Nordics, that arrangement had to be changed, but I think that's the way in which they were doing it back then, and I assume that's probably what's going on now. All right, so here's a story about a new whistleblower who has had a 22-year career in the US Air Force, and he's created quite a stir because he says that he served in a 20 and back secret space program. So he's a career US Air Force veteran. He's done many things that are related in some way to the UFO issue, to the UAP issue, and he has talked about that. Now, and this is coming out in a new video documentary by James Fox. Now, I don't know if this is something that's mentioned in Fox's upcoming documentary, or something that Jason Sands just kind of like discussed in a podcast, but he spilled the beans that he also served in a 20 and back secret space program. Now, you know, what's very important here is to emphasize that the first reference to a secret space program that involved the 20 and back program was back in the year 2000, and that was by Michael Ralph, who was working with his wife at the time, Stephanie Ralph, and they put out a two-volume book series called The Mars Records, where they described the kind of debriefing, or they used kinesiology to be able to work through the kind of mind control trauma that was suffered by Michael Ralph during his military service. He served, I believe it was a six-year term going back from 1976 up until 1982, as I recall. So that was Michael Ralph in 2000. And then the next person to talk about a 20 and back was Randy Kramer, who came out in April of 2014. And I actually was the one that first broke the Randy Kramer story. And he used the pseudonym Captain K at the time, but then later on he came out with his full identity. Now, that's important because after Randy, there was another whistleblower that came forward, and he had a show on Gaia TV and worked with a number of people, and it became very controversial. And unfortunately, the level of toxicity that he's created around the 20 and back program because of all these court cases and trying to assert intellectual property right over these terms and trademarks and so forth has meant that now new people like Jason Sand, who come forward and say, I served in the 20 and back program, they're now discredited because the 20 and back term has become toxic because of this individual that has been involved in a number of court cases and litigation and tried to assert intellectual property claims over the term 20 and back. But there is no trademark for that particular term. But nevertheless, this is what's been created. And so it's very unfortunate because Jason Sands has now been labelled as someone that's not reliable because he used the 20 and back term, which apparently is mainly associated with this individual that I've worked with in the past who has introduced this level of toxicity into the field. And that's very unfortunate because he was not the first. He does not own the trademark to that. He was not the creator of the term 20 and back. Randy Kramer used that term explicitly in those interviews we did together in early 2014. And that was before this individual came out there and got involved in Gaia TV, and I did interviews with him as well in early 2015. So Randy Kramer was the person who explicitly was talking about 20 and back in 2014. Okay, so Jason Sands has issued a public statement standing by his assertion of being back part of a 20 and back program, and that's very significant. So let me maybe I should read this out to you. Let's see if I can read it out. Regarding the processes of whistleblowing and the various bodies involved, the National Defence Authorisation Act outlines the whistleblower process, not the Inspector General. Okay, so this is a little too detailed. I think it might be better I just leave it to you because there have been a number of inaccurate statements made about Jason Sands and his security clearances by some individuals. I think one of them was, Richard Doty was one who made a particular comment about Jason Sands' security clearance. And Eric Davis, another one, it's Dr. Eric Davis. Both of them have made what Jason Sands believes are disparaging claims about Jason Sands and his claims. And so he issued a report. He issued a statement about that. And I think he also released his DD-214. So that's also available online. You can actually go here, and I think you can see his DD-214, which is very, very significant because that confirms his background. And so here's his DD-214. And this is issued to all military personnel upon discharge. So we can see here that he was his full name, Jason Theodore Sands. He was Air Force. He served for 22 years. He net active service in this period, 22 years, 10 months and 16 days. Station where separated, Randolph Air Force Base in Texas. And so this confirms that he's a 22-year U.S. Air Force veteran. So to me, right away there, That means that this is a credible source. But people are trying to shoot him down, trying to maintain that he's not credible, because something about his security classifications doesn't mesh with what others say was the standard practice. Eric Davis, Richard Doty, who believe that there's something awry with the statements that Jason Sands has made. And as I said, also Jason Sands claiming to have been part of a 20 and back program, that was immediately associated with this other individual who unfortunately has made the 20 and back term a toxic term. And that is very unfortunate. And it's like, well, if someone was working for the intelligence community, wouldn't they do that? Wouldn't that be the MO of an intelligence operative? I think this individual, from the years I worked with him from 2015 up until 2021, I think his testimony was groundbreaking, no doubt about it. But at some point, there had been a turning, 2019, 2020, something had happened, and I definitely became very uncomfortable with the direction things were going in. And eventually we parted ways in 2021. And his story definitely took a direction that I just don't find to be very credible at all. And he's created a lot of division and a lot of toxicity with some of the basic terms used with secret space programs, such as 20 and back. Very unfortunate. Okay, so here's a former senior Pentagon official, Christopher Mellon, who worked with the Department of Defense's, I think it was he was the Undersecretary for Security and Intelligence within the Pentagon. And he wrote an article about some information he received from a senior government official around 2020, and this official discussed the recovery of a UFO that landed in Kingman, Arizona in the 1950s. Now, this revelation is a very important one because what it does is it supports the testimony of Bill Uhouse, who was a U.S. Air Force veteran, and then he became a contractor who worked on U.S. Air Force reverse engineering programs involving a fully intact flying saucer that was retrieved from Kingman, Arizona in 1953. So Bill Uhouse, he was a Disclosure Project witness back in the year 2001. He was part of that initial group that came out with that Dr. Stephen Greer put out, and he created a book called The Disclosure Project. And I think I even have it right here, this Disclosure Project book. Oops, no. Oh, yeah, I think it is. Yep, here it is, The Disclosure Project book. And one of the testimonies in here is from Bill Uhouse. So Bill Uhouse, his testimony has been around since 2001, former Air Force veteran and also a military contractor. And he says that he worked with a gray alien that would come in and would give answers to questions that engineers and technicians had about reverse engineering this fully intact UFO that had been recovered from Kingman, Arizona in 1953. So, you know, his testimony was around in 2001. And since that time, he did write a book, and he also has given a number of interviews confirming all of that, and he described the name of this gray alien that was called J-Rod. Now, that was his claim. So now Christopher Mellon, this former senior U.S., this Pentagon official, says that he was told by another senior U.S. government official in 2020 that there was a fully intact craft recovered in Kingman, Arizona in the 1950s. So to me, this is powerful corroboration for the testimony of Bill Newhouse. Now, this is the part of the problem that I'm seeing with people that are very interested in whistleblower claims of individuals such as David Grush, that, and of course, now we've got another one, Jason Sands, who's come forward, JP that I'm working with. He hasn't revealed his identity yet. It's not yet safe for him to do that. Hopefully, it will be safe at some point, but we haven't yet reached that point. Now, it's important to acknowledge that, there have been hundreds of insiders or whistleblowers that have come forward previously. And kudos to Dr. Stephen Greer in 2001 that he put together these testimonies and put it out in a book that that researchers can study. And when I got involved in exopolitics initially, for the first 10 years, this was like my Bible, this book. Just because you have the first-hand testimonies. But these first-hand testimonies from these credible individuals are largely ignored by many UFO researchers, and that's very, very unfortunate. Many of the major UFO researchers that have established big reputations, have quite a following, they dismiss this. They say, well, Greer, he didn't vet a lot of these witnesses. They're just telling a lot of stories and didn't vet them, and they cherry pick, or they kind of like nitpick testimonies to shoot them down. And Barry Sands is starting to go through that. I mean, as I mentioned, he had to respond because you have some people like Eric Davis and others nitpicking or identifying things that they say doesn't kind of like, the I's aren't dotted or the T's aren't crossed. And this is a classic way in which credible whistleblowers or eyewitnesses are undermined, because you'll have these UFO researchers that aren't really interested in the big picture. It's a sensational story. Bill Newhouse here said that he worked at a classified Air Force facility on reverse engineering a captured extraterrestrial spacecraft that was recovered from Kingman in 1953. It was fully intact, and there was an alien called J-Rod that would come in and answer questions from the technician engineers. That's really significant. But instead, you'll get UFO researchers that nitpick about things such as, if Bill Newhouse is a credible whistleblower, where's his DD-214? And in his DD-214, it says that he was stationed at this base for this long, but in his testimony, he claims he was at that base for this amount of time. And so they'll kind of nitpick and find ways to undermine a person's testimony, and that's very unfortunate. Okay, so here's an interview I did with Robert Morningstar, and he is a lifetime contactee. He says that at age 3, he began to have these experiences with aliens, with greys, and that his psychic abilities were enhanced, and that the Office of Naval Intelligence got interested in him, and he became an asset for the Office of Naval Intelligence, and he became involved with the Coast Guard and so forth. And he was also involved in some testing of some of these classified technologies. He describes these programs involved testing things such as a mind technology interface for advanced craft, or especially retrofitted craft such as F-14s and F-15s. Now, the F-15, that got my attention, because the F-15 craft, that was the one that Stephen Chua, that is a Singaporean super soldier that Elena Denham got to interview back in 2021, that Stephen Chua said that he went to Area 51 in the early 1980s, and that he was asked to fly a specially modified F-15 F series. And that was equipped with this mind technology interface. And he says he flew that effortlessly because he could handle the brainwave activity that would be generated by this mind technology interface that it required gamma brainwaves. As long as a pilot had sufficient gamma brainwaves, then they could fly this craft. And that normal pilots, Air Force pilots that flew that craft, after having a pharmaceutical product injected into them that would temporarily boost their gamma brainwaves activity, that they would suffer brain injuries. And so Robert Morningstar is saying that he was also exposed to some of these experiments that existed at the time, or back in that era in the 80s and so forth, where they were testing these mind interface, mind technology interface systems that were being incorporated in planes such as the F-15F and apparently the F-14. So Robert Morningstar, he's been doing the UFO circuit for many, many years. I got to talk to him extensively back in 2008 when I got involved in investigating claims of a series of secret United Nations meetings involving a disclosure plan that was being this was all being released revealed, pardon me, by a Navy whistleblower who was in Navy reserves. He was in a lieutenant commander, and unfortunately, he was outed, which meant that individuals were able to identify him. And so he had told us, he had told myself, Robert Morningstar, and Clay and Sean Pickering, those are two individuals that worked with Richard Tillman most closely. He told us that if he were ever outed, he would be compelled to deny everything. And, you know, I didn't believe that that would actually happen. But it did. It happened. And sure enough, he was outed. I think it was in 2010. And 2 years of working with this individual was kind of like blew up in smoke because he had the backtrack. He said he had to do it. So that was unfortunate. But nevertheless, Robert Morningstar, myself, the Pickerings got to see Richard Tillman's military credentials. And we know that he was genuine U.S. Navy pilot, but he had to backtrack because this was the condition for him to be able to reveal the information. So it does show that military personnel that reveal current operations operate under strict conditions. And I've already mentioned a couple of times JP, who's currently serving with the US Army, and he has to follow similar conditions. He cannot reveal himself, which is why I go to great lengths to protect his identity. I don't mention anything about anything other than that he's active service with the US Army. I don't mention the military base he's working at or the different programs and details, specific details about the bases where these operations are conducted out of and so forth, even though I know them. So Robert Morningstar definitely is someone worth following. The interview, you can watch that. And he's also got a website. It's the robertmorningstarsubstack.com. He's got some very interesting articles. You can subscribe. I don't believe you need to. Okay, yeah, you can subscribe here. And there it is. It gives you a lot of interesting stories. Here's one, Russian flying saucer recoveries, Chinese UFO crashes. So, you know, Robert Morningstar, he's been around the block quite a few times. So if you're wanting to learn about what's going on, you're wanting different perspectives, then definitely Robert Morningstar's someone that can give you a different perspective. Okay, so here's Billy Carson, who is someone that has appeared quite a few times on Ancient Aliens. He's got his own online show, and he has released, he has authored a couple of books. He has done a lot of research on the emerald tablets, on this Thoth, this mysterious wisdom teacher called Thoth, or God, whatever you want to call Thoth. He's done a lot of work on that. And he says that he had an experience with a gray extraterrestrial, and I forgot the actual date that he mentioned, but here's the video. It only goes for a couple of minutes, but he is saying that he saw this gray extraterrestrial appear in, actually I think it was two grays, appear in his living room while he was watching a cable TV, and that the rest of his family were in the rooms and all of that, and none of them kind of like detected anything going on. But he describes the powerful emotional impact on that, and he relived his emotions, and it's very clear watching this that this is a traumatic experience that he lived through, and he says that the experience ripped his family apart because his family didn't believe him. His son thought that he was creepy after this experience, because his son now associated Billy Carson with these extraterrestrials, and so that's very sad. So yeah, Billy Carson, kudos to him for, you know, being prepared to reveal exactly what happened, the emotional impact that had on him, destruction of the family unit, and why this was something very, very real. So, you know, this to me is just one example of many of eyewitnesses of extraterrestrials or non-dimensional or non-human intelligence, because they could be from the inner Earth or from another dimension. Many, many testimonies that I think are very, very credible and need to be considered, and not just kind of thrown under the bus as being incredible, you know, because people say, well, you know, Carl Sagan, credible claims require incredible proof. And it's like, well, you know, clearly incredible claims require an incredible investigative process. And if you're so dumb as to think that people can supply, you know, copious amounts of hard data to substantiate the presence of extraterrestrials and inner Earth beings that are being hidden by secret government organizations and the US militaries and corporations with incredible resources to suppress and eliminate and kill people that disclose all of this. If you demand them to release the hard evidence because Carl Sagan says that should be there, well, you know, you're a dumbass. Sorry. Incredible claims require an incredible investigative process. Okay, so here's something. The Shenzhou 18 is China's seventh crewed mission to the Tiangong space station. So Shenzhou just means divine vessel. And it's China's 13th human spaceflight mission. So, yeah, why is this relevant? It's because China is not a party to the International Space Station. So China had to set up its own space station. Now, why is that? The US and European nations early on realized that China was in the business of stealing the intellectual property of Western scientific organizations and corporations, and they did it shamelessly. And they would shamelessly steal intellectual property and reverse engineer that property. And so the US and the Europeans realized that, well, if China was admitted to the International Space Station program, that they would continue to do that. And if China was, and they had to send a clear message to China, say, look, we're not going to stand for this, especially when it comes to advanced space projects. So they said, well, if you want to be part of the International Space Station, you know, these are the conditions. China said, you know, F you, whatever, and went their own way. But I think it is very important. I've written a book on China's secret space program. It's called Rise of the Red Dragon. It's called The History and Origins of China's Secret Space Program. So I'll go into the detail about China's secret space program. And China's sitting on a lot of secrets. There's no doubt about it. They have a lot of ancient technology that they sit on, they've been sitting on for decades. They did not want to share that with the United States and the Europeans, because China, I think, quite rightly recognized at back in the, say, 1990s or in 1980s, the 1990s, early 2000s, China recognized that their scientific technical base was quite inferior to that possessed by the United States and the Europeans, especially the British and the French and certainly the Russians. And so the Chinese decided to sit on a lot of advanced technologies that they had recovered from crashed sites in China. China's a vast landmass, and China also has buried pyramids. It has vast underground tunnel systems filled with technologies from ancient civilizations. China has not shared this because they understood, and I think rightly, that that the US and the Europeans would study this technology. They would take away the biggest kind of technological breakthroughs that that technology offers without sharing it with China. And China has been waiting up until recently, where China's scientific technical infrastructure is sufficiently developed that it can now develop its own reverse engineering programs. And so this is why there is this kind of separation between China and the rest of the international spacefaring community, why China is not part of the International Space Program. And also I did a update from Thorhan Oredjan, who is Elena Danan's primary contact with the Galactic Federation of Worlds. And he described how China has gone its own separate way and is not cooperating with this International Space Alliance that has been set up, with the US being the core or at the center of that, and that the Nordics and other extraterrestrial organizations like the Galactic Federation of Worlds, the Ashtar Command, the Andromeda Council, the Council of Five, and so forth, that these organizations are working with the US and the Earth Alliance, whereas China is going its own separate way, developing a parallel program. And so this is something that is a concern, and so we need to track China's developments in space, because China, just as the United States did, uses a conventional space program as a cover for a secret space program. So the Apollo program was a cover program for the United States setting up a secret space program, as was the international, as was the space shuttle and the International Space Station, and so forth. Now, here's a very interesting development. Russia vetoed a United Nations resolution on nuclear weapons in space. So this was a United Nations Security Council resolution that was proposed to affirm the 1967 Outer Space Treaty, which prohibited the stationing of nuclear weapons in space. So the United Nations Security Council wanted to pass a resolution saying that, yes, we reaffirm that nuclear weapons cannot be placed in space. Now, Russia vetoed this. Russia, along with four other countries, make up the permanent members of the United Nations Security Council. And for any resolution to be passed, it requires the consent or the... Sorry, none of those five members can vote against the resolution for it to pass successfully in the U.S. Security Council. So because Russia refused to approve this resolution, then that resolution failed, even if it's like, I think the vote on this one was 13 to 1, China abstained, and 13 nations wanted to have a resolution prohibiting the establishment of nuclear weapons in space. I think it's great. I think it's good. And so why did Russia do this? So this is where we get some speculation on my part. Now, I think the reason Russia did this, and in particular President Vladimir Putin did this, is that he understands that the United States has an overwhelming advantage in terms of advanced space technologies that it's developed in its secret space program and in both the civilian and its military space alliances, so the Artemis Accords, and also its military space alliance, the Combined Space Operations Initiative, and also in secret agreements that have been reached with visiting extraterrestrials. I already mentioned the agreements that were reached in 2021. They're called the Jupiter Accords, where the US was made the undisputed leader, or was made the leader of a kind of core executive committee of six nations to help the Earth Alliance, or Earth's major spacefaring nations, coordinate with the Galactic Federation of Worlds, because the Galactics said, well, you know, we don't want to deal with a committee. What we want to deal with is one nation that represents the interests of all of the nations. And because the United States had the dominant support of the major spacefaring nations, and we're seeing that from the Artemis Accords, then the Galactic Federation said, the United States, you're it. China objected to that. Russia was also not very happy with that. Now, that happened in 2021. Now, Russia's special military operation in the Ukraine happened in 2022. And so since that time, I think President Putin has been shocked at the extent to which the United States is trying to sabotage Russia, and the kind of efforts that the US is doing, the Biden administration is doing. And I think, you know, we're talking about, with the Biden administration, we're talking what I believe to be a deep state puppet regime, if you like, that Biden is doing the bidding of the deep state. And the deep state wants the United States to create an enemy of Russia. And to do that, they are funding and encouraging Ukraine to fight this war against Russia and not seek peace. Now, this is one of the few examples I can think of historically where the United States and European nations are not encouraging a peaceful resolution of a conflict. Rather than encouraging a peaceful resolution of a conflict, they're pouring arms into it. I mean, it's never happened before. I was a professor of international peace and conflict resolution at American University from 1996 to 2001. I was a full-time tenured professor. I was an assistant professor. I was full-time though. And never have I heard of any major nation trying to promote a conflict involving another major nation like Russia to the extent that the United States has been doing with its allies. So I think that President Putin has seen and understood that the deep state at any time can turn the US around to pursue its agenda. So I think what he's doing is that he is saying that Russia is going to place nuclear weapons in space. We don't want to be party to any agreement, any treaty that prevents us from doing that, and because our strategic interests dictate that we I don't think the Russians are going to say that we're going to put nuclear weapons in space. I think they want to leave it ambiguous. And I think they want to do that because it will give them a kind of a de facto veto in space operations. Because if other countries suspect that Russia has nuclear weapons in space, that means Russia's interests in space will be heard. Because what we're seeing now is that Russia's interests on Earth are not being heard because Russia has interests in the Ukraine and they have not been heard. Simple as that. And so rather than hearing those interests, the Europeans and the United States are pouring funds and weapons and encouraging this war in Ukraine to continue on without Russia's interests being considered at any time, without any effort to pursue a sincere diplomatic process. So I think Putin has looked at all of this and said, okay, we want to make sure that this doesn't repeat itself in space, so we are not going to be party to any resolution prohibiting the establishment of nuclear weapons in space, because that is our most powerful card. Russia and the United States have the world's biggest stockpiles of nuclear weapons, so it would not be very difficult for Russia to have nuclear weapons in space. So I think this is a part of Russia's efforts to ensure that in future space operations, as the United States and its allies in the Artemis Accords establish this Star Trek future, that if Russia is sidelined, as it's been sidelined currently, or even if Russia is brought in at a later date and said, oh, you know, you can come in, but, you know, you're going to be, you know, signatory number 44 or 45, you know, you're not going to have a real big influence in the way the Artemis Accords and the Combined Space Operations Initiative are conducted. Russia will say, fine, but we are going to hold on to our nuclear weapons in space, because I think that is Russia's final card to ensure its interests will be respected. All right, well, here's something that kind of like I thought was very interesting to comment about. So this is the Galileo project that is based in Harvard University. And so they got a grant for $575,000 from the Richard King Mellon Foundation. And that money is going to be used to establish a third UAP observatory station to gather empirical data for papers and conference presentations. And you know, obviously that's going to provide detailed empirical data that can be analyzed by multiple authors that could then speculate on what's behind the phenomenon. So, you know, you think about this. I mean, you've got literally hundreds, thousands of videos, of photos being taken of UFOs. You've got eyewitnesses that are saying that we're being taken onto the UFOs, that these are extraterrestrial spacecraft, that some of these craft are secret space program craft. JP, who I've mentioned several times already, he's got photos of craft that he has taken, so and of craft that he says he was taken on. So JP not only says he was taken on craft, flying saucer craft that are part of a extraterrestrial or Nordic space program, he's also being taken on triangle-shaped craft or rectangle-shaped craft that are part of an Air Force run, or now it's a Space Force run, secret space program. And in addition to his testimony, he's got photos. He's taken photos and even video of this. Now, so what you have is the Galileo project being funded by over $500,000 to come up with a third UAP observatory, while all of these photos, all of these videos, all of these eyewitness accounts of people that have been taken on UFOs, on these flying saucers or flying triangles, flying rectangles and so forth, they're ignored or ridiculed. So, you know, I mean, you have to ask, is it just me or is something awry here? I think there's something really wrong with this, that all of this major funding, and I understand the argument. Some people say, well, you know, Sala, you know, hold your horses. The Galileo project is really opening the door to a lot of skeptical scientists out there that want overwhelming empirical data, scientific data that shows that this is a real phenomenon, and that's the target audience. And I understand that. And I think that that's a good thing. That's a step in the right direction. You're opening the door there. But still, there is a giant mismatch between the kind of resources and the funding that goes to people within the UFO, within the university community or within the scientific or corporate realm that are talking about UFOs, but are discussing it in a very limited way in terms of the empirical data surrounding UFO sightings and not examining the social science data that emerges from the eyewitness testimonies of people that have been taken on the craft. Now, unfortunately, I was removed from the university because I took that eyewitness data seriously, and I was removed, simple as that. Now, this, I think, has to change. People within the university system should be allowed to talk about whistleblowers, eyewitnesses, contactees who have had these encounters and talk about that without being punished. Now, I know one of the members of the Galileo Project is this University of North Carolina professor, Diane Pasulkas, who does interview some eyewitnesses and some contactees. And that's good. That's a step in the right direction. But there's a lot more than what Dr. Pasulkas has covered in her books, and a lot more than she's discussed. And so I think this kind of funding for a understanding the UFO phenomenon more needs to come towards those witnesses or programs or institutions or NGOs that want to support witnesses. I mean, people that have had these eyewitness accounts, you know, they need to be brought in and given a kind of screening, or their testimonies recorded, subjected to testing, whatever testing you want to determine the credibility of their claims. But it has to be done in a social science framework as opposed to an astronomy department, which is really looking at developing new telescopic observation devices. So, okay, fair enough. His Galileo Project has its third observatory station, its third set of telescopic lenses to investigate UFOs. Okay, fair enough. You want to play with the astronomy community, that opens their mind, that's okay. But we've got to look at the overwhelming data from eyewitnesses and the experiences and the photos, the videos that they have. Well, that is pretty much what I wanted to cover from my Twitter feed. The final announcement I want to make is that today, Saturday, 27th of April, is 1 week to my next webinar. So the next webinar, as I mentioned, Russia's secret space program, its enigmatic cycle. That is something that I'm very excited to present the data that I've been able to get to show the reality of this. I think it's fascinating. Russia is a major player in space programs. It is a country that cannot be ignored. Russia and China and the United States are the three major countries whose space programs I think we need to look at. And so now I'm very happy I'll be able to look in detail at Russia's secret space program. I hope to be able to write a book about this over the next 12 months. So definitely, I hope you can join me on Crowdcast for this webinar, and I look forward to seeing you there. So that's it for the Exopolitics Today Week in Review for April 27. Thank you for watching and supporting my research. I look forward to seeing you next week.
You have been listening to Exopolitics Today with Dr. Michael Sala. Please remember to like, share, and subscribe to this channel. Join or start a conversation in the comments. Take the time to explore the vast library of best-selling books, webinars, and podcasts by Dr. Sala. Visit exopoliticstoday.com.